Evidence and Answers begins right now.
This is Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukeran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics. The defense of the Christian faith. Is the New Testament historically reliable? Were the Gospels written too late to accurately preserve the words and deeds of Jesus? Today we will continue in our interview with Dr. Ben Shaw, president of Core Apologetics and author of Trustworthy. His latest book is about alleged contradictions in the Bible, the reliability of oral tradition, the identity of the gospel writers, and the historical tests scholars use to evaluate ancient documents. If you've ever wrestled with doubts about the Bible, this is a program you won't want to miss. If you've joined us late in any part of this broadcast, log on at evidenceandanswers.org, and there you will find this interview entitled Trustworthy, 13 Arguments for the Reliability of the New Testament. Plus, you'll also find hundreds more podcasts that you may download or listen online. Now let's get right into the conclusion of this fascinating interview.
You talk about them writing and preaching their message in a hostile arena. If what Jesus taught is true, then the old Jewish religious system was coming to an end. And you bet they wanted to do whatever they could to discredit the message of Jesus and the gospel accounts. And so they would have been picking apart these guys. And if they were fabricating things about Jesus doing miracles or the tomb being empty, you bet these guys were scrutinized. And had they been caught in fabrication or something, the enemies would have jumped all over them, don't you think?
Yeah, that's one of the things about Christianity that's so unique. Its central claim is a falsifiable one with Jesus's bodily resurrection. They could have claimed spiritual resurrection, and then you can't falsify that. Like, oh, you guys can't see his spirit, but trust me, it resurrected, you know. But they claimed a bodily resurrection. And if there was a body to produce, they would have produced it. But they didn't. Rather, they gave another reason for why the tomb was empty. Mm-hmm. So they're acknowledging, and they call this enemy attestation, but they're acknowledging the tomb was empty when they're giving this alternative explanation for why it's empty, which is, of course, that the disciples stole the body. That's what they're saying. But in saying that, they're acknowledging, yeah, tomb's empty, but here's a different reason. And it's the same thing with Jesus as a miracle worker. He's doing these wondrous acts, but they're really sorcery. He's doing some evil things. So again, not denying the activity, but altering the cause. And we see that in the Gospels too. You know, he does this by the power of Beelzebub. They're trying to give a different explanation. Okay, the things happen, but let's find an alternative explanation for it. And it's interesting because it kind of reminds me of Matthew 11, where it says, Jesus talks about people who are given evidence. And for some people, it doesn't matter what evidence you're given. Played a dirge for you, you didn't mourn. We played a song for you, you didn't dance. John came neither eating nor drinking, and you said, this guy's crazy. I came eating and drinking, you said I was drunk. In other words, no matter what evidence is given to you, you have a different interpretation of it, because all you really care about is yourself. And that kind of goes back to the Enlightenment, right? Where anthropology becomes the definer. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so all those things kind of come to mind for me anyway.
Yeah. Now, speaking of writing in the lifetime of the eyewitnesses, one of the criticisms is that we don't know who the authors were they have a valid point. The earliest manuscripts don't have the names. This is Matthew. This is the Gospel of Mark. This is the Gospel of John. And so how do we know that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were the authors of the Gospels if they weren't in the earliest manuscripts there?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, it's interesting. My book, Trustworthy, it's technically anonymous too, because I never say I, Ben Shaw, have penned this book as you're reading it now. Mm. So my book's anonymous, but yet we know who wrote it, right? You've got a number of books on your bookshelf. I can almost promise you 100% of them are technically anonymous as well. We don't write like that. And so if we do that today and we have ways to know who wrote things, this is true for school papers. Think about school papers. They don't say, I, Ben Shaw, submit this paper to you, Professor Zukeran. I have a title page. I put Ben Shaw so you know who it is, but it's not in the body of the text. So it not being in the body of the text actually is pretty normal. There's other ancient works that were technically anonymous in this sense, and we know who the authors were. So, one, it's not like the Gospels are the only ones. Two, we've got modern examples from today. But three, from a practical perspective, you have to know who the authors are, because if I'm when they're making copies of these letters and these Gospels to circulate them to other churches, if I come to your house and I'm like, hey, can you get me a copy of Mark's Gospel? I want to send it out. And you've got, I don't know, 50 scrolls in your, on the back wall there. They would have to have a way to identify them. Otherwise, every time someone asks you for something, you got to unscroll every single one in order to find it. But if you have a tag on the outside, or like we have on the spine of our books, our last name and the title, now you can easily find it and hand it off to someone else. So those are some elements there. But more to the point, that's just the context. The earliest evidence we have is unanimous that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were the authors of the Gospels. And Simon Gathercole has a great, it's a technical article, but it's very good. And it's on the alleged anonymity of the Gospels. And he goes from around 100 AD to 200 AD and has 16 different sources that attest to either Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John as the author of Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. That's pretty good evidence to have 16 sources attesting within 100 years of the writings. So very, very good evidence. And again, if they this all indicates to us that they these are just some of the reasons, but why their authors were known. They weren't intended to be anonymous. If they were intended to be anonymous, another problem would be, why is it unanimous that it's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Wouldn't someone have come up with a different name, a competing name? Like, what are the odds? For example, let's just say we wrote an anonymous gospel today. I'm in Virginia, you're in Hawaii. If we're both looking at the same anonymous gospel, what are the odds we're both going to come up with the same name for that gospel? Two totally different cultures, context, right? You guys are on an island. We're up here in the mountains. I mean, you got volcanoes there, but we got just totally different setups and our histories and all those things. But we're going to come up with the same name for these gospels, and that's not just going to happen one time, but it's going to happen four different times. I don't know. That seems a bit much. A recent debate on that was really good was Mike Lacona versus Bart Ehrman. They've recently debated this issue too, to if you want to get into it in more depth.
When they did start putting names on these gospels, right? Yeah, as you're saying, from all different parts of the Roman Empire, the early church fathers did, as you're saying. I mean, it was all the same. Matthew wrote Matthew, Luke. You don't see, well, gospel 20 saying this gospel is by Peter, and 30 saying, well, no, this gospel is by Matthew, and no, this gospel is by Barnabas, and they're trying to figure it out and say, let's just pick Matthew. No, it
Yes,
was
exactly.
all from all different parts of the Roman Empire. It was Matthew, and John and things. So we can be pretty sure that we've got the authors. And I think also, I mean, if you didn't know who the authors were, I don't think you'd pick a guy like Mark, who wasn't one of the 12. You'd probably pick Peter or something, right?
Brett or Luke, who's a Gentile. I mean, not again, not a disciple. Both these guys are traveling companions, so it's interesting. But we see why they were picked, why they wrote. Mark was Peter's interpreter, so I mean, he had been around Peter. He knew what he was preaching. And this goes back to the gospel dates discussion, because the dates, it's not as though, even if we take the late dates and Mark's writing at 65, it's not as though Mark's just all of a sudden, 25 years have gone by, and like, yeah, you know what? That was a good time 25 years ago. We should write this down. They had been preaching it that whole interim. It's not as though it was just something spur of the moment. So all those things kind of coalesce with respect to the Gospels to bring this general reliability to them.
Yeah, speaking of that, tell us about oral tradition. A lot of people will say, well, these were preserved orally. And when we were in college, we were taught the telephone game, right? I whispered in the ear of the guy in the front row. By the time he gets to the 50th student in the back row, it's a totally different story. And a lot of people say, so you see all kinds of legends and myths and exaggerations crept in that the feeding of the 15 became the feeding of the 5,000 by the time the gospel writers decided to write it down. So how accurate is that oral tradition?
So there's a couple ways to go at that. First off, obviously, when we're playing a game, that's totally different than real life, right? So when people's lives are on the line and suffering is on the line and your eternal soul and security is on the line, okay, things get a lot more serious really quickly. So the whole point of the game is to have fun and change it up a little bit. And you don't pay any price for changing it. You get some laughs, so all the more you want to change it. So that's one. But two, oral traditions were already in operation prior to the New Testament being written, because the rabbis would pass off tradition to one another. And especially in a culture that was largely illiterate, they weren't functionally, not everyone was functionally illiterate. They could read signs, like on the Titulus, for example, of the cross, but reading longer accounts would be something more substantive. So how do you teach and communicate things to people if they can't read longer tracts? And we can't produce them because it's expensive to do all that too. Well, you have these oral sayings and teachings done in ways that are easily memorizable, that you can recall quickly. And so the rabbis would do this. And so they had actual technical words for the passing off and handing off of traditions. And it meant to entrust this material to someone who could not only maintain it, but they could pass it off to someone else as well. And Paul uses this exact same language in 1 Corinthians. He uses it two times in 1 Corinthians, one for the Last Supper and the other for the gospel. So these are traditions, these are oral traditions that we know were being properly preserved, because this is how they would teach things. We even look at Jesus's teachings. They're often in parables, stories, said in ways that are easily memorized. But it's the same thing with these oral traditions, because in 1 Corinthians 15, and by the way, there's probably about at least two dozen oral traditions preserved in writing in the New Testament for us. And in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul is reminding the church of what he preached to them. He's reminding them of the oral tradition he gave to them when he was there. And he says all this. So it's not like this isn't an interpretation. The words are quite clear in 1 Corinthians 15. And he says, I delivered to you that which I also received. And this is of first importance. And just before that, in verses 1 and 2, he says, this, it's the gospel that I preach to you that has the power to save. And then he goes on to say that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, and that he appeared. And then he gives a long list of appearances. And scholars generally date that tradition along with 1 Corinthians 11, along with Philippians 2, along with Romans 10, 9, a big one, to the early 30s AD. Because Paul would have heard it as an early persecutor. He would have likely heard some of those things. He could have learned some of that from Ananias when he got discipled in Damascus. But regardless of where he got it, whether it was earlier than that, he would have confirmed it with Peter and James in Jerusalem when he met to visit with them in Galatians 1:18 to 19. And there he uses the word historesi, which has the idea of getting firsthand experience, firsthand discussion. And Galatians 1 is about the gospel. We just mentioned 1 Corinthians 15. Paul says the gospel that has the power to save. These are the things that he is talking about in those discussions. And of course, if he says, I received it, that's one of those technical words. That means if he received it, it would have been in existence earlier than that meeting in Jerusalem. And so as a result of that, it's almost universal, which we don't have that ever, ever in scholarship. It's almost universal that scholars are in agreement that that information from that oral tradition is not only connected to eyewitnesses like Peter and James, but it also dates to the early 30s. So quite incredible.
That's amazing. Creeds like 1 Corinthians 15 that you mentioned, 3 through 8, speaks of the death and resurrection of Christ. Even the skeptics like Bart Ehrman, Marcus Borg, those who would reject 90% of the New Testament, affirm that these creeds were around within the first 5 years, right, of the empty tomb.
And then you've got guys like James D.G. Dunn and Larry Hurtado. They would say within weeks or months of the cross. And then Gerd Ludemann, who recently passed away, he said Paul received this information within 2, not later than 3 years. There's a Jewish scholar named Pinchas Lapid, who he said that 1 Corinthians 15 may be considered a statement of eyewitnesses. So you have, I mean, it's just, it's historical criteria. And when we're applying our historical methods to these texts, these are the things that we start to see. And we know, and some people may go, oh, well, maybe Paul was just saying that. Maybe Paul was just saying that to the church in Corinth, but that's not what they were really preaching. And you go, oh, really? That's interesting. At the beginning of 1 Corinthians, wasn't there a division in the church? Because some people were saying they were baptized by Peter. So they knew Peter. They knew the message that Peter was preaching because they were baptized by him. Well, yeah, I guess they would have known that. What about 1 Corinthians 16, when Paul's telling them, hey, we're taking up a collection and we're going to take it to the church in Jerusalem? And guess, who's the leader of the church in Jerusalem? James. and Peter's likely going to be there, so he could at least go confirm it with the church in Jerusalem. So they're already planning a trip to go together. And this is why Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15:11, whether I'm preaching it or they're preaching it, this is the gospel. This is that one that has the power to save. And whether I preach it or they preach it, so you believed and so you are saved. So yeah, I think it provides it's a good case, and that doesn't even mention the suffering they were willing to endure as a result of that.
Well, so wrap this up for us, Ben. I mean, we talked a lot about the historical criteria. And so summarize it. What is the criteria historians look for when they measure, the accuracy of an account that claims to be historical?
And this isn't, again, this isn't just for, I mean, we do a lot of this today, but we do it in the ancient past as well. But we want to have multiple independent sources. Not all sources are weighted the same. Embarrassing testimony, enemy testimony, they add weight to a claim. So a quick case of embarrassing testimony. When Peter confesses Jesus as the Messiah, he gets some compliments, and then Jesus says, "Well, just so you guys know, the Son of Man is going to be delivered up and be crucified. In 3 days, he's going to rise again." And then Peter rebukes Jesus, and then Jesus calls Peter Satan. You know, that's pretty embarrassing for the leader of the early church to be called like that. Is not what you want. And but it's in Mark. It's in the early, considered to be the earliest gospel. And you're like, oh, he even included this. And there's many examples of this embarrassing and throughout Scripture, Old and New Testament. So those add weight historically to accounts, and each of these add weight to the historicity of an event. If you're missing one, it's not like it takes away. There's only one criteria that takes away from historicity, and that's contextual credibility. That just means it has to be consistent with the things of that time. In other words, if I were to tell you the disciples were riding motorcycles, you're going to go, buddy, okay, I don't know what you're telling me, but it's not history. So that's a good example there. And so we have these different criteria, and we can use them. But I mean, there's so many other aspects to it that we didn't, we don't have time to get into. But archaeology, you've got Christian sources outside of the New Testament. You have non-Christian sources outside of the New Testament. Since I wrote my book, a new book on Josephus has come out arguing for the authenticity of the entire passage, published by Oxford. It's available for free. So it's a great resource there. So there's spiritual transformations that people have. Not that that proves the New Testament, but if the New Testament is true, we should expect to find those things. And then you got the minimal facts approach, which means if we're wrong on all that, well, we still get the gospel and the deity, death, and resurrection. And that's Habermas's work and legacy there.
And one of the things people attack are these alleged contradictions, especially in the Gospels. Like, I think Matthew 21, Jesus curses the fig tree and it seems to wither immediately. And then Mark 11, that same account, it seems like they're walking out of Jericho the next day, I think, and the fig tree is withered, kind of thing. How do we handle alleged contradictions in the Gospels and in the New Testament?
Yeah, there's a couple ways to go at it. Well, let me give a good resource for it first. There's a book called The Big Book of Bible Difficulties by Geisler and Howe, I believe it is. It's an excellent resource. It covers like every contradiction you could alleged contradiction you can think of. But a lot of the times they're just differences and differences in the ways in which people tell stories. And there's flexibility in our language. And that allows us to tell stories in certain ways that just are conducive to whatever our scope and our audience is, like our intentions and our purpose, our aims. And so I like hockey. Yeah, I mentioned that earlier. If I were to tell you, I saw a hockey game last night and Mariner scored an incredible goal, because he did, between the legs. It was amazing. And you were like, well, I saw the game, and I saw all these other guys playing the game. And I don't know who your favorite player would be, but we'll just stay there. You saw Eichel play. Okay, so you gave a name, I gave a name. Oh, well, look at us. We disagree with one another, and that's a contradiction. Well, no, we're just spotlighting two guys we care about because those are the guys we follow, or one guy had a great play, so I want to identify that. Like, oh, it was between the legs in a playoff game, no less. So that's an amazing thing. So I can spotlight on someone. It's not to the exclusion of others. And so, for example, they talk about the women at the tomb. How many women went, or how many angels did they say? If one mentions one and one mentions two, they're not saying it was just one and only one with the women at the tomb. Even John is the only one that says Mary went. But then when she goes to the disciples, it says, we do not know where they put. So John's spotlighting on Mary. She's a significant figure. So I think the flexibility of language addresses a lot of these things. But then the big book about Bible Difficulty is just a great resource to have on your shelf if you can't quite wrap your head around one. I think they go through so many. So it's a good resource there.
And that's what we would expect, right? If they're four independent sources, we would expect them coming from different angles and including different details. If they got together and said, hey, let's put a work together, and they come out all identical, you'd be going, wait a minute. I mean, even in a court case, right? I mean, if everyone's testimony is identical, you'd be going, wait a minute, you guys collaborated here. We're going to throw all this out. So that's what you would expect. And the fact they didn't smoothen out these difficulties would show that these are independent accounts.
There's an author by his last name is Dudgery, and Jeremiah Johnson has also written a book chapter on the subject. But if the gospel authors were making things up, they did a terrible job. That's the essence of these two articles. Because when you look at later gospels, they try to smooth out things, and they do so in just some curious ways. But that's the point they make. And then one of the other elements is undesigned coincidences. There are stories that are told in which, and just to use the most, probably one of the most well-known ones, is the feeding of the 5,000. And in John 6, Jesus asks Philip where to get the food to feed everyone. And you might go, well, why is he asking Philip? What significance does that make? And we know from John 1 that Philip's from Bethsaida. And you're like, okay, well, again, so what? But when you have two stories that give an account and they shed light and they can illuminate that picture, that adds credibility because they're sharing these stories with different aims, intentions, and purposes. It's in Luke we find out that this happens in Bethsaida. And if Philip is from Bethsaida, well, now we understand Jesus is asking the hometown guy where to get food. So like if I'm coming to Hawaii, don't ask me where to get the good food. We're going to ask you where to get the good food. And so it makes sense. But it's not like John and Luke were getting together going, man, we got to convince these people that this miracle took place and Philip got asked where to get the food. Like that is such a trivial detail to the whole thing, but it lines up properly because it's two people telling the same story from different purposes or from different angles.
Yes, folks, you've been listening to our interview with Dr. Ben Shaw. A lot of the stuff that we talked about comes right from his new book here, Trustworthy, 13 Arguments for the Reliability of the New Testament. Fantastic, very readable book here, written at the popular level. Outstanding work here. And Ben is also the president of Core Apologetics. So before you leave, Ben, why don't you tell us a little bit of Core Apologetics and where they can get information on you and Core Apologetics.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much. So Core Apologetics, part of my story as I was describing it there was I felt like I had to go to grad school to get discipled. And so I kind of think that's, I don't like that. And so part of the mission and vision of Core is to use apologetics to help churches, organizations, and individuals build disciples and minister to those with doubts and questions. And so having that strong apologetic component, we think apologetics is good discipleship and good evangelism. You're doing those two things. And so it's very holistic. It's the head, the heart, and the hands. But some of these are key facts that help encourage us to read our Bibles, because if you don't understand your Bible, it's harder to read it. And now when you can start understanding, when you know Paul wrote half the New Testament, that starts helping you as you're reading it. At least it did for me when I came to Liberty. So as we understand our Bible better, we'll read it more often. And there's all sorts of studies that talk about if you read your Bible, how much better that is for you. So we try to help churches and organizations do this. We do talks, but we also do live webinars online so people can ask and engage questions with us. And so we have a webinar right now going on regarding the case for the resurrection. And so we're wrapping that one up. Dr. Habermas will be joining us on that one. So that'll be exciting on our final session. But we also do one on Trustworthy. It's 6 weeks. We meet once a week for 6 weeks and we go through two chapters a week and just get to go through these discussions. And if you got questions, you can ask them, because our goal is to help equip believers so they can be confident, prepared, and ready to live out their faith and be disciples in all disciplines, because we don't want to outsource our discipleship to the pastors. We're all called to be faithful believers. And we don't want to have to go to get a college degree just to be a disciple. So how can we help get this out there to everyone?
Yes, you've been listening to our interview with Dr. Ben Shaw. Great ministry there, Core Apologetics, that we endorse here at Evidence and Answers. And of course, discussing his recent book, Trustworthy here. Great information you're going to get. And it's really going to enhance your understanding, but also ability to defend the historical reliability of the New Testament. So, Ben, thanks for being with us here on Evidence and Answers.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Our time today has come to a close. Be sure to join us again here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number there is 483-0586, or email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit that subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Once again, log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran.